You know, I really didn't think I needed to come all the way from the UK to come and talk to Australia about HIV and human rights. I mean, you're all doing so well, aren't you? Ending HIV, getting to 90-90-90, making PrEP available. And there's so many brilliant people working on this issue, including the people who've just been speaking before me. But I have to make a special mention of our own senior policy analyst, Sally Cameron, sitting here in the front row. And of course, our own board member, Paul Kidd, who spearheaded the repeal of Victoria's HIV-specific criminal law a few years ago. Never mind the man for whom two HIV centres are named for, Justice Michael Kirby. I know how brilliant you all are. I mean, come on, this is the country that coined the term strategic positioning and gave us the not only Kylie, but also Kath and Kim. I mean, as a gay man, I really want to thank you for that. But there's wonderful people at Asham and at NAPWA insisted, in fact, that they were very persuasive. And apparently, despite all these wonderful and more than capable Australians who could talk to you this morning, apparently it's my English accent that gives me this air of authority. Although I'm not sure being English gives anyone any authority at this these days, you know, Farage, Boris, Brexit. And plus, you do so much better at Eurovision than we do these days, too. So here I am to deliver a keynote on behalf of people living with HIV all over the world. And I'd like to take a moment to recognize all the people living with HIV who are currently incarcerated, including someone very close to home, trans sex worker CJ Palmer. Now, I'm here to highlight the work that I do as the global coordinator of the HIV Justice Network. As you've heard, working to end the inappropriate use of the criminal law to control and punish people living with HIV. And to reiterate what I'm sure most of you already know, science is amazing and life-changing. I mean, after 35 years of living with HIV, I'm proof of that. But, you know, we need so much more than science to end HIV, if, in fact, ending HIV is indeed possible. So first, a little bit about me. You've already heard that I've been living with HIV for 35 years, and I actually came to Asham in Canberra in 2011 to deliver a keynote then. But to be honest, it was memorable mostly for the road trip from Sydney with the wonderful late Alan Brotherton, who I'm sure many of us miss. And this is, in fact, my fourth trip to Australia. My first in 2000 was supposed to be my first and last. My doctor at the time, Julio Montane, yes, I had the fortune and privilege to be under his care as a salvage therapy patient in Vancouver at the time. He told me I should enjoy this trip of a lifetime with my now ex, Edgar, because I'd completely run out of treatment options. But then science happened, and I survived, although the relationship didn't. But why a picture of Paris, I'm hearing you asking? Actually, it's Blackpool, the English seaside town where I grew up. Now, every year, my parents took me to see the Blackpool Illuminations, which are also affectionately known as the Other Northern Lights. And I would always look for the broken light bulbs. I couldn't enjoy the big picture because I always noticed the detail. How did they get broken? Who was going to fix them? And they always say the devil is in the detail. And I'm still looking for those broken light bulbs. So let's talk about 90-90-90 by 2020. Ambitious targets, and it looks like you're almost there. In fact, these data are 2 years old, so maybe you already are there early, like Sweden or London. And as Jeffrey Lazarus told you 2 years ago, it's also really time to start measuring a fourth 90 anyway, one that focuses on good health-related quality of life. And what about your ending HIV by 2020 campaign? Test often, treat early, stay safe. The power of science. And then there's this equally powerful U equals U movement, ensuring that we all understand and internalize that undetectable is transmittable. It's powerful stuff. But in fact, a number of us worked with Bruce Richmond, the architect of the U equals U movement, to ensure that he added a third U, unequal. Because viral load does not equal value, and not everyone has access to treatment or viral load testing or is able to achieve an undetectable viral load. And U also stands for universal, and science isn't going to end HIV without universal access. Now, you don't have to look too far from here to see what those of us working on HIV and human rights have known for a long time. You can't reach the marginalized, the criminalized, or the stigmatized with science alone. And these are data from the University of New South Wales Stigma Indicators Monitoring Project. More than half of people living with HIV in Australia, sometimes, often, or always, experience HIV-related stigma or discrimination. And it's experienced in lots of settings. In the media, criminal justice, of course, housing, child and family services, at work, at home, in bed, and in healthcare settings. Look closer at how many people living with HIV in Australia experience HIV-related stigma or discrimination in healthcare settings. Why would someone turn up for testing, treatment, or ongoing care if they anticipated being treated this way? That's not good for the cascade, is it? So that's why UNAIDS and its co-sponsors recently partnered with the Global Network of People Living with HIV and the Community Delegation of the UNAIDS Governance Board, the PCB, to launch the Global Partnership for Action to eliminate all forms of HIV-related stigma and discrimination. The concept is simple. Every government has signed up to this in various political declarations, even if they didn't realize it. We just need to remind them of their commitments, show them how it's done, and ensure the resources are allocated accordingly. And you can hear more about this and how countries in the region are dealing with HIV-related stigma and discrimination in healthcare settings later this afternoon at 4 o'clock in Meeting Room 1 at a session co-chaired by myself and the fabulous Jules Kim and featuring the equally fabulous IAS President-elect, Dr. Adiba, as she's affectionately known. So I dug a little deeper. And I discovered that the Ending HIV website does talk about ending HIV stigma. Great, but like U equals U, it focuses on the individual, which is also great, but we know that stigma and discrimination are products of the environments in which we live. And there's no greater manifestation of HIV-related stigma and discrimination than laws or prosecutions that single out people living with HIV for behaviors that would not be a crime if they didn't have or didn't know they had the virus. As Justice Edwin Cameron told the Beyond Blame conference in Durban in 2016, by reinforcing stigma, HIV criminalization makes it more difficult for those at risk of HIV to access testing and prevention. It also makes it more difficult for those living with the virus to talk openly about it and to be tested, treated, and supported. I'm going to talk a little bit about what are typical HIV criminalization cases. Most cases involve an HIV-positive person having sex where it's alleged they didn't disclose their HIV status. But many cases involve potential or perceived exposure only with no HIV transmission alleged, or negligible risk, using a condom, someone with a low or undetectable viral load, engaging just in oral sex, but also for spitting, for biting, for scratching. And there's also faulty assumptions of guilt where transmission is alleged. For example, the first person diagnosed in a couple is often considered to be the first infected, and phylogenetic analysis is rarely used, and even where it is, results can be misinterpreted. In fact, amongst the thousands of known prosecutions that we have monitored over the years at the HIV Justice Network, cases where it was proven beyond reasonable doubt that an individual wanted to infect another person with HIV are unusual and extremely rare. Now, I'm here, as I say, to represent people living with HIV all over the world, but what's missing so far from the conversation this morning are the voices of HIV criminalization survivors. And at our Beyond Blame conference in Durban in 2016, we were fortunate enough to have three incredibly brave and courageous individuals share their stories, and I'd like to share them with you now.
Lieutenant Colonel Ken Pinkella was court-martialed by the US Army for alleged HIV exposure, despite no evidence that he and his accuser were ever alone together.
Pinkella, as of 4 weeks ago, I used to be a career lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, but the appellate process is over, and at the end of that process, I have now been dismissed from the Army. In technical terms, I've been erased, literally. So I chose to wear this with some good advice. It may be one of the last times, but I want to make sure that as we present another phase of this discussion of HIV criminalization, that we recognize that there is no privilege. HIV knows no bounds. And it seems that the stigma and the hate knows no bounds either. So as you hear our stories, I hope you please also remember, we all have families, we have friends, we have coworkers, we have entire communities that are also affected by what's happened to us. On a daily basis, we are reminded of that. So I had two things against me. I was openly gay and I was openly HIV positive. Everybody knew it. But they took me to trial without anything. And the results of that trial was I spent 272 days in Leavenworth Military Prison, which was not fun. And since then, I've been fighting. And with the help of Edwin and Sean, I will continue that fight. It doesn't matter if there has been transmission. It doesn't matter if there was even no sexual act, or in legal terms, no means likely whatsoever to expose a person to any disease, regardless of even HIV. I cry every morning. It just comes out that I'm standing here after a wonderful career on an international stage with such amazing people, and I've lost everything. I am now actually a burden on the very society I chose to defend. And it's wrong. It's wrong, especially when you haven't done something. There was nothing there. I've had people approach me and say, well, you must have done something. There is still that feel, even advocates, because the story is so unbelievable and so remarkable. You must have done something. And we fight that, even internally, every day.
I'm Gary Thomas. I was convicted under Idaho Code 39608 for two counts of attempt to transfer the HIV virus. Even though I had protected sex, I am always used a condom. And I've consistently had an undetectable viral load. My sentence is two 15-year sentences to run consecutively with a minimum of 20 years.
Carrie, yeah, he's here. He's actually here. Carrie, just for the benefit of everybody sitting here, which is amazing, I wish you could see it, could you let us know where you're calling from? So we're going to hand the phone over to Nana.
It's a great honor and an opportunity to have to get a chance to speak with you guys. It's amazing that people all over the world who are not only fighting to end the HIV epidemic, but are also working to end the criminalization that remains polluted at its core, by the fear of HIV and the stone and the stain for people who are infected as well. You know, this stigma related to HIV produces discrimination in areas such as housing, employment, access to medical care and treatment, even what I call the pursuit of happiness. And it's the same stigma that continues to drive the toxic criminalization that harms far too many people living with HIV. People like our friends, our families, our loved ones, and we look at it, even society as a whole. I think everyone in this room all recognize that HIV criminalization impedes HIV prevention and the treatment efforts. So the question that I bring is, what can I do or how can I help change this? As you know, I'm currently incarcerated in Boise, Idaho. I'm in the seventh year of a 30-year sentence for not being able to prove that I disclosed my HIV status to my then-girlfriend. And one thing I want to be clear that today I believe that no one needs to face HIV alone, whether they're inside prison or outside of prison. Today I believe that the chronic illness of HIV, is manageable and full of hope. I believe truly HIV is beyond blame.
And Harry, you just got a standing ovation here at Beyond Blame in Durban, South Africa.
Rosemary Namaburu, a nurse from Uganda, spent 10 months in prison after she was prosecuted following unfounded allegations that she exposed a young patient to HIV following a needle stick injury.
The police arrest was so brutal. I was paraded in front of the media and the people and the police. The newsmen were called. They took photos of me. They made headlines and they made man out of me. Very ugly, calling me murder, killer. When I was released, I felt uneasy to go back to my house. I had to look for refuge somewhere up country with my relatives for 10 months, where I stayed for a while until when I returned to my house eventually and the dust had settled. This has totally changed my life. And self-esteem is gone, and the pride of more than 30 years in the nursing profession, in the nursing I loved so much. I want to be a face of the struggle against stigma and criminalization. I saw it all, I faced it all. I don't want anybody else to go through the same. I've lost everything I had, and I want to go back to where I was. And I need everybody's support to regain my life and start not only to be able to put food on my table, but also to fight for the other people out there who are going through such act of injustice.
So the effects of HIV criminalization are pervasive. Despite the relatively small number of cases, it affects all people living with HIV due to fear of prosecution, fear of extortion, fear of retribution from disgruntled former partners. We track all cases globally, but who's counting cases here in Australia? Who is supporting people from complaint through arrest, investigation, incarceration? And who is getting prosecuted? The same people who are not counted in the 90-90-90 targets or the focus of the Ending HIV campaign. African migrants, sex workers, trans people, the stigmatized, the marginalized, the people without access to white or cisgender privilege. Now, 3 years ago, Asham issued this statement against a recently enacted law, in fact, three recently enacted laws, allowing for mandatory testing for anyone who spat at law enforcement during arrest. But we need more than slogans and more than statements, as powerful as they are. When science is ignored, what happens next? Who takes responsibility? And when you start asking questions, when you see the impact of these laws and of HIV criminalization here in Australia, you'll be amazed, you'll be shocked, you'll be stunned. Tomorrow at 4 o'clock in meeting room one, I'm promising you minds will be blown. Here's a map of where HIV-related criminal cases have been reported. It's from our Advancing HIV Justice 3 report that Sally led on and I co-authored. And it shows you the HIV criminalization, how broad it is. And you can see the map of Australia. There have been cases reported in pretty much every state or territory. But obviously, you're part of a much wider problem. And as I mentioned, you can find out so much more about what we're doing as a global movement to end HIV criminalization, not only where the problems are, but how the solutions can be found in the Advancing HIV Justice 3 report, which can be found on our website. One of the things that we do at HIV Justice Worldwide is that we focus not just on people living with HIV as an individual, but understanding that HIV is only one of many identities that we have. And so we're building an intersectional movement. And this is actually from our Beyond Blame in Amsterdam, where we had panels on feminist perspectives and looking at how we need more than science, where human rights fits in. We have done incredible work in the last few years because we've been able to build this global movement thanks to funding from the Robert Carr Fund for Civil Society Networks, which was the first funder to really recognize the importance of this issue and why the movement needed to be coordinated and needed to be global. And we've been able to advance HIV justice from Mexico, where we intervened at a case in the Supreme Court and a law in Veracruz was found to be unconstitutional, to Malawi, where we supported a group of incredibly amazing, powerful women with HIV who protested at the reading of an omnibus HIV/AIDS bill in Malawi that had been been proposed for about 10 years that had some really draconian HIV criminalization provisions. And it was their actions on the final day of the reading that that forced parliamentarians to understand that HIV criminalization laws don't protect women. They make it much worse for women living with HIV, and they actually removed the most problematic provisions from the law. And those are just two of the examples you'll find in our Advancing HIV Justice 3 report. One of the things that perhaps you're more familiar with, and one of the things that I think we're most proud of, is that we worked together with IAPAC, with IAS and UNAIDS, on the publication of an expert consensus statement on the science of HIV in the context of criminal law, published last year and launched at the International AIDS Conference in Amsterdam. It's already had a huge impact, both in terms of media reporting, framing the issue as being unscientific and stigmatizing, with obviously amazing lead authors, 20 of the world's leading experts, including my former doctor, Julio Montana, and a number of former and current IAS presidents, including, of course, Dr. Adiba, and your own Andrew Grulich. There isn't enough time to show you all the amazing work done by our colleagues around the world to combat HIV criminalization, but if you come to the NAPWA symposium, Not Guilty, Living with HIV in the Law, on Thursday morning at 7, and I assure you it's worth getting up early for, which is again in meeting room one, you will be further enlightened. So a few concluding thoughts. We're not going to end the HIV epidemic by singling out people living with HIV as criminals. HIV prevention is a public health issue, not a criminal justice issue. Having a health condition should never be a crime. HIV criminalization hinders HIV prevention and care efforts, including those 90-90-90 targets, increasing everyone's vulnerability to HIV. So our efforts and resources must focus on greater access to prevention, testing, treatment, and care for all, and not criminalization. Now, scientists, clinicians, and other healthcare providers can help combat all kinds of stigma and discrimination against people living with HIV by working with the most marginalized communities, challenging misconceptions around living with the virus and how it's really actually transmitted. So we don't just need science. What we need is human rights plus science. That's what leads to HIV justice. I'd like to thank all the members of the HIV Justice Worldwide Steering Committee. They're all listed here. And to ask all of you to join the movement by going to the HIV Justice Worldwide website and signing up. Thank you very much.